everyone. Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
I think this is a very innovative approach to solving a longstanding problem in Chicago.
The city considers a new model for developing affordable housing. Efforts to address achievement gaps among Black students in Chicago public schools. And celebrating the history and community of public housing in a new Chicago museum. And now to some of today's top stories. The stock market surges to one of its best days in history as President Donald Trump announces a pause on some of his tariffs after facing a global market meltdown. The Dow surged 2,900 points, or 7.9% today, while the S&P rose 9.5% and the NASDAQ closed up 12%. It comes after Trump announced a 90-day pause on his tariffs for most nations, but kept in place that 10% baseline rate that went into effect on Saturday, which is lower than the 20% or higher tariff that some countries were facing. A big exception was Chinese imports, though, as Trump said he was raising the tax on those to 125%. People who took part in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol may soon be blocked from working for the city of Chicago. Members of City Council's Workforce Development Committee passed the measure today, which now heads to the full council for a vote next week. Backers say January 6th rioters should not be able to work for the government they tried to overthrow. Alderman Nicholas Spezzato was the only committee member to vote against the ban, calling those who fought with the police, quote, despicable, but says people who entered the Capitol without permission shouldn't be prevented from working with the city. In January, Trump pardoned more than 1,500 people who were convicted of attacking the Capitol. And older people could be reconsidering a settlement payment to the family of Dexter Reed after a previous settlement failed to advance. Dexter Reed was the 26-year-old driver killed by several plainclothes Chicago police officers in March of last year during a traffic stop. An initial investigation by the Civilian Office of Police Accountability showed that Reed first shot and wounded an officer before the other four fired 96 rounds in 41 seconds, hitting him 13 times. The previous settlement agreement was for $1.25 million, $1.25 million, and would ban CPD from requiring officers to make a certain number of stops. It failed in committee. The City Council Finance Committee will again review the deal Friday. It could go to the full council next week. Advocates are calling for solidarity and resistance from Northwestern officials as the university faces investigations from Washington. It comes a day after the Trump administration announced plans to freeze nearly $800 million in federal funding earmarked for the university. More than 1,000 faculty members, alumni, students, attorneys, and community members say they've signed letters expressing their support for the university's academic freedom and First Amendment rights. Northwestern is facing investigations from the U.S. Department of Education and a congressional committee into its response to anti-Semitism on its campus. You can check out our website for more background on this story. And white supremacist extremism is alive and growing in Illinois, according to a new report that says the number of hate crimes reported in the state rose by 362% from 2019 to 2023.
We're talking about an average of one incident every 3 days for the last 5 years. This has included stickers and flyers targeting members of immigrant, Muslim, Jewish, LGBTQ+, Black, AAPI, and Latino communities, and women as well. In other words, no one has been spared.
The new report from the Anti-Defamation League tracks hate incidents by county in Illinois, including white supremacist events and propaganda like flyers, anti-LGBTQ+ incidents, and even terrorist attacks. In Cook County, the report says anti-Semitic incidents increased from 46 to 209 between 2020 and 2023. The group says 68% of incidents in 2023 occurred after October 7th, the date of the Hamas attack in Israel. Coming up, a new approach to building affordable housing in Chicago. We explain how it would work next.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Mayor Johnson's newest effort to reduce the city's massive affordable housing shortage ran into a wall of deeply skeptical city council members today who delayed a planned vote. But the proposal may still be on track for a final vote next week. Here's Alderman Brendan Riley, a frequent critic of the mayor.
The concept, the idea is a good one, but my God, the devil is in the detail. I think this could be a great tool for Chicago, but we have to get it right.
WTTW News reporter Heather Sharone joins us now with more. Heather, so this proposal would create a city-owned nonprofit housing developer. How would that work?
Well, if you remember, about a year ago, the city borrowed $1.25 billion by ending a whole bunch of tax increment financing district. This plan would take $135 million from that fund and use it to set up the city's own housing development corporation, which would have the ability to sort of fund these projects in the place of private equity or other sort of banks or financial institutions. The idea is that since the city's, you know, a public entity, they won't be as concerned about their return on investments, which will lower the cost to build these apartments, and it will help chip away at the city's shortfall of nearly 120,000 affordable units.
So if approved, Chicago would be the first big city to try something like this. What concerns did we hear from city council members today?
Well, since this is really untested in Chicago and really nationwide, the Alder people had a lot of questions about the board that would run this nonprofit corporation. It would be made up of a combination of city officials and real estate experts. They wanted to know who this board would report to, what the city council or the mayor could do if they think that the board has made bad decisions. Oh, and what about the state's open meeting law and FOIA, our favorite state law that makes sure we get the documents to know what these state officials and city officials are doing. So there were a lot of technical questions and exactly whether this would work to sort of build these units or rehab existing units. But I think there was a consensus on the committees today. It was a joint session of the Housing and the Finance Committee that the city had to do something because there is not going to be federal money for at least the next 4 years to fund these sort of projects.
Like Alderman Brendan Riley said, the devil is in
yes.
those details. Details are devilish. So what happens next? What does this delay mean for the prospects here?
Well, they didn't have the votes today because of all of those concerns. But this delay until Monday gives the mayor's administration 4 days and the weekend to sort of, you know, talk through some of these issues. And they'll come back on Monday and maybe there'll be the votes to advance it. That could set up a final vote on Wednesday at the full city council. If they can't get it done, it'll have to wait another month.
Okay. Heather Sharone, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And of course, you can read Heather's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. Chicago Public Schools is pursuing a new plan to address inequities its black students face. The Black Student Success Plan aims to bring in more black teachers, reduce suspensions and expulsions, promote teaching on black culture and history, increase belonging, and close opportunity gaps. But it's also facing federal scrutiny from the Trump administration. The national conservative advocacy group Parents Defending Education says the plan is discriminatory and has filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education. So joining us now with more are two people who helped create this plan, Dakota Irby, a professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, and Dwayne Davis, president of Raising Expectations, an education consulting firm. We also reached out to Parents Defending Education but did not receive a response. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you for being here. And I know you are at least currently or previously CPS dads as well. Dakota, I want to start with you because you also led community meetings to develop this plan. Talk about why you think it's important to have an equity plan specifically for Black students.
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. Thanks for having us on. It's important because Chicago Public Schools has a huge Black student population, serves a large number of Black families and communities, and it's very important that we meet the education needs of this particular population. Because this is a group that has historically not had the same kinds of opportunities as other student populations. For Chicago Public Schools, this has to be a priority. We've seen declining enrollment amongst Black students and families leaving the district. So it's imperative to actually get this right, make sure students have access to the educational experiences and opportunities that are gonna give them the outcomes that lead to college and career and family sustaining careers.
So this isn't the first time the district has done this kind of work, though. How did past equity efforts sort of inform the current work of this Black Student Success Plan? Yeah.
So this can kind of be traced back to a committee that was formed that actually led to the opening of the CPS Office of Equity in 2018. And the CPS Office of Equity has been leading the charge to improve the Black students' experiences in the district, amongst other student populations as well. So it's really been their charge. And this is also something that is codified and supported through Illinois Public Act 103, which created for the Chicago Board of Education a Black Achievement Committee. And so there's a broad range of kinds of supports behind this Black Student Success Plan.
Dwayne, same question to you. You know, what makes this plan different from previous efforts?
So to piggyback on Dakota's comment, I believe that as a lifelong Chicagoan, as a public school graduate, as a parent, as a just a person that cares about our kids, we've been working at this for a long time. And one of the data points that's super important to me is about young people getting access to college. We've been on the kind of college pathway in our city for over two decades. And the lowest performing set of young people in our city are Black girls and Black boys. Their college attainment, their college graduation, their college retention. So if we think college is the access point, college is a way to change generational wealth, college is a way to decrease the racial wealth gap, we have to get that right. This is super important, and we need to focus on the plan, work the plan, and figure out how to move students and move the metrics for families in Chicago.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get back to a little bit more about that achievement gap in just a bit. But Dwayne, tell me a little bit, if you would, about how this plan came together, because I know you both led, you know, some community meetings. What did you hear from the community, and how did all that work?
Yeah, so it was great to travel the city, as a listener. So going to the west side of Chicago, sitting in elementary schools, talking to young people, talking to parents, talking to community activists, going to the north side, going to schools, and just hearing what they wanted for their young people. There was some, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if we should do this way. We've talked before, and things haven't happened. But the Illinois Public School Act that Dakota mentioned, the way it's codified in policy, the way we're having this national conversation, the local conversation about our students, I think gives us some breadth and depth, and communicates and coordinates the work that's going to be done in our city. So those meetings were just key, hearing student voices, parent voices, and community voices in those spaces.
So we know that Black students have been struggling academically in comparison to some of their Black and Latino counterparts. According to the 2024 Illinois report card, almost 60% of white students in CPS are proficient in English and language arts. Now that's compared to 21% of Black students and 24% of Hispanic students. And just for context, I want viewers to know, Black students make up about 31% of the CPS student body. Dakota, how will this plan address these disparities?
Yeah, well, one of the priorities is to adopt culturally responsive teaching in classrooms. And it's supposed to increase by a certain percentage. And that's for teachers, including Black teachers. One of the other key pillars of the plan is to increase the number of Black teachers and retain Black teachers, but also provide teachers of all different backgrounds with the kinds of competencies that will allow them to engage in the teaching of Black history, as well as to engage in kind of culturally competent and culturally responsive teaching approaches, which we know from research for many years is demonstrated to actually improve students' academic outcomes.
Also, as we mentioned, Parents Defending Education, they filed a civil rights complaint against this plan, and they say, quote, CPS is failing students of all races and ethnicities, which makes this racially segregated program all the more egregious. CPS's racially exclusive plan also runs afoul of this education department's own guidance, referring to the U.S. Department of Education. Dwayne, are you concerned about, you know, what is, first, what is your response to that?
So I would say that Chicago Public Schools has a legal office, and they are going to pursue and defend and do the work necessary to protect the work as the policy in our state guides them. And what I also say that we're in a blue state. We have a governor that is engaged in a different way. So I think that just like I'm a literacy person and a literacy expert, we're a banned book safe state. I think our politics in the state of Illinois also give us some cover and some protection and thinking about what we're going to do for students and families in our city as well.
That said, Dakota, are you concerned about this sort of national anti-DEI movement and these policies and the potential impact that they could have on this plan for CPS?
Yeah, I am concerned. I think everybody should be concerned about what's happening nationally right now. As Dr. Davis mentioned, we are in a blue state. We have a supportive mayor. We have a supportive board of education here in Chicago Public Schools. So a little bit less, but overall, yes, I am concerned about the potential, you know, funding cuts, people being targeted, those sorts of things are definitely concerning. But we have been insulated from book bans, from, you know, cuts so far and those sorts of things. But it is concerning. I think people should be concerned. This is not a time to sit on our hands and think that things are going to blow by. I think we have to be vocal. I think that people need to be adamant about making sure that students, black students, but students of all different specific needs get the resources and opportunities they deserve.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Best of luck to you both, Dakota Irby and Dwayne Davis. Thank you so much for joining
us.
Good to see you. Up next, what you can expect to learn at the newly opened National Public Housing Museum. Stay with us. A museum to commemorate the history and community of public housing has just opened in Chicago. But the National Public Housing Museum isn't just a museum. There's also a workforce program, a recording studio, and actual affordable housing units all on site. And it's been nearly two decades in the making. So joining us now to tell us more, Lisa Yung Lee, the National Public Housing Museum's executive director and chief curator, and Reverend Marshall Hatch, pastor of the New Mount Pilgrim Missionary Baptist Church, whose childhood home is replicated in the museum. Welcome back, both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
So, Lisa, let's start with you. Why do you think a museum for public housing is necessary?
Well, there's never been a museum that's more relevant to all the issues that we should be thinking about today. But it's not just a museum about public housing. It's about public education, public safety, public health. It's about all the things that we value in a commonwealth. And so when people come, they're going to be enthralled. They're going to have their perceptions challenged. They're going to learn things, feel things, and they're going to want to do things about housing and justice.
You all explained that the museum was created by and for residents of public housing. How does that principle sort of shape the exhibits and the storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, from jump, public housing residents were the people who imagined and envisioned this museum. Ms. DeVera Beverly, who was the head of the Central Advisory Council, she had the brilliant idea for a museum where public housing residents themselves could participate in the narrative about what public housing is, what it's going to be for in the future, and we amplify amplify their voices and their stories in all ways, including in the apartments that we've restored in the museum.
Well, to that point, Reverend Hatch, you grew up in the Jane Addams homes, and your childhood home is, like we said, replicated in the museum. What memories kind of come back to you when you walk through that space?
Well, you know, it was surreal when we walked in. I walked in with my older sisters. We lived there for 14 years. I was a kid. It was an ideal environment, really. We had a lot of friends, a lot of close and tight-knit families. And so we get to talk about really what it felt like to live in a tight-knit community, to have what I would call family-friendly public policies. We went to the neighborhood public schools, stayed in public housing, and it really benefited our family and gave us a great start.
You describe public housing in your youth as, like you said, tight-knit, but also economically integrated. What do you think people misunderstand about life in public housing?
Well, this museum, of course, tells a story that originally public housing was built for European immigrants. In this case, at the Jane Addams, for Italian-American immigrants, for Jewish-American immigrants, and then eventually African-Americans moved in. So this was a project that was to help families get a leg up. And it really did that for our family. My mom, you know, tragically passed away in that unit in the snowstorm of 1967. My father finished raising us in the community. And it was it just tells a story of how we can do better than we've been doing in terms of supporting families and helping them get a leg up.
Lisa, there are plenty of pop culture portrayals of public housing, like Good Times or the Candyman movie, and some of those show up in the museum. But why did you want to also include those fictional depictions of public housing in the museum?
So much of what we do is challenge the stereotypes that we all live with when we hear the word public housing. It brings up a visceral feeling for so many people. And so we do tell the Candyman story, and you do understand sort of the history of Good Times. I mean, work with Cabrini Green residents to pick their top 10 favorite episodes in one of the exhibits. But like Reverend Hatch said, you also will encounter the Turovitz family who moved into the Jane Addams homes in the 1930s, a Jewish family that when we asked them, what did public housing mean to you? They said, it means having our first kosher kitchen, never touched by pork. You also will learn from a beautiful exhibit that is created by Manuel Sinema and Kyunga Yamada Taylor about the systemic injustices that changed the demographic of public housing, the GI Bill and its racism. We will understand sort of the history of redlining. And then also you'll have a gallery where you'll encounter the personal stories of people from Sonia Sotomayor, who lived in public housing, to George Floyd, who lived in public housing also in the Cooney home. So it's, we always say, never again will a single story be told as if it's the only one. And when you come to the National Public Housing Museum, you're going to encounter so many compelling stories.
And of course, many of us, we know the history of what happened to many of those high-rise public housing buildings in Chicago and them being demolished. But after that happened, Reverend Hatch, I kind of want to move on to, you know, what you think was lost when those buildings were demolished.
Well, you know, we had tight-knit communities. And when I grew up there in the late 60s, the mid to late 60s, early 70s, they were, as I've said, economically integrated. Like when my mother's crisis happened, there was a nurse that lived in public housing right across the lawn from us. There was a policeman who lived next to them. So somewhere along the line, it was public policy, maybe inadvertent consequences that created these narratives as pockets of poverty. But it was not that in the beginning. And we get to tell a different story about how important it is to look at all of us living together and everybody having a right to a house.
Lisa, the back of the museum, 15 units of public housing are attached. The space also doubles as a community center. Why was it important to include housing in these programs in this institution?
Yeah, I mean, the National Public Housing Museum is really an example, a sort of case study for the future of civic institutions and the potential of museums to be cultural civic anchors doing so much work to transform society. So, you know, a museum is a mixed-use space where you'll have beautiful art and history and artifacts, but we're also creating spaces for housing and also for people to gather to imagine the future of housing. And so that's the 21st century museum, and we really believe that we exemplify that.
Before we run out of time, I have to ask, Lisa, the Trump administration, of course, just announced these cuts to the National Endowment for the Humanities, which affects cultural programs and museums across the nation. Does this concern you?
Yeah, this is a really big concern. It should be not just for museums and libraries, but for all Americans. You know, we need to challenge, I think, the legality of these cuts, and we also need to hold government accountable for the people and their role in not just providing housing, but for providing vibrant arts and cultural and library and libraries and other types of institutions that serve all people.
We'll have to leave it there. Congrats on the opening of the museum. Thank you for sharing it with us, Lisa Yun Lee and Reverend Marshall Hatch. Thank you.
Thank you, Brandis.
And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10, one-on-one with City Council's newest member, Alderman Anthony Quezada, about his priorities for the 35th Ward. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm serving Chicago for 37 years.